said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here for a second time this year with my friend David Sirota, who was the communications director for the Bernie Sanders campaign, is a blogger and just one of the most penetrating writers, going back to when we worked together on the Ned Lamont campaign, and he had produced a book called Hostile Takeover. And I think that book is quite germane to the questions that I want to explore with him today as we sit on the cusp of the election, which takes place tomorrow, November 3rd, in the United States. One other note before we go to the issues, I want you to join me in wishing David a happy birthday. He agreed to come and talk with me today on his birthday, and I think that's a great place to, how would I say, sculpt and define the gift that we as a body politic should all be giving to David for his leadership as a journalist. David, thank you for being with me. This is good. It's really timely, and I'm very grateful.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
So we have a president in power, Donald Trump. We've had the Biden campaign win out on the Democratic side. And ever since the Biden-Harris ticket was defined, most of the campaign on the Democratic side has been about what you've got to do, meaning the body politic, our audience, is you got to vote and you got to get rid of this crazy president. Before we go on and talk about what to do if Trump wins or what to do if Biden wins, let's talk about that notion first, that the Democrats don't have to offer what they're going to do. They're just saying get rid of Trump is sufficient for a sigh of relief. And I'm interested, how do you characterize who is Donald Trump? And why is he so frightening to so many people?
Well, Donald Trump is, for the most part, an extrapolation of what the Republican Party has been pushing for decades. There's a whole school of thought that says Donald Trump is an anomaly, but I think that for in many cases, he is an extrapolation, and that's a little different than an anomaly. An anomaly suggests that he is singularly different from his own party. An extrapolation is that he is an intense expression of what his party has been pushing. And I think for the most part, he is an extrapolation. That when you look at his economic policies, when you look at his social policies, even when you look at his effort to suppress the vote, these are things that the Republican Party have been trying to do for decades. So I think that you have certain Republicans in the media, Republican operatives and the like, trying to pretend Trump is an anomaly because they're embarrassed and they know that their party is culpable for creating Donald Trump and the policies that Trump has pushed, and they're humiliated by that. So they're trying to create some distance. But I think we need to understand that much of Trump is an extrapolation of what the Republican Party authentically actually is. Now, I do think where Donald Trump differs from other past presidents is in one particular area, which is that half of the presidency is really about managing the government. It's about policy. It's about legislation. It's about the executive branch and the like. The other half of the presidency, though, is about managing the nation's psyche, its attitude, its outlook on life and on the world. And Donald Trump, I do believe, is the first president in the modern history of the country who wakes up every day and in that part of his job is trying to incite, is trying to destabilize, is trying to sow anxiety, is trying to mess with our psyche in a way that even past terrible presidents have not tried to do every single day. You can get into a debate, you know, is Donald Trump a worse president than George W. Bush and Dick Cheney? And, you know, you got to be really a bad president to be worse than George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And so I find those debates kind of worthless because, for instance, the Bush-Cheney presidency was absolutely hideous and awful. And I realize that we can no longer even remember the Iraq War, or the financial crisis anymore, because we now have a collective memory of 15 minutes. But that presidency was awful. And I think it's we don't gain much by having a debate over whether Trump was better or worse than George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the like. But I do think that even George Bush and Dick Cheney, who were absolutely destructive forces in American politics, did not wake up every single day trying, actively trying to destabilize America's psyche. I mean, we were manipulated by them. Their case for war was a lie. You can say all of that. But they were not trying to sow on a daily, hourly basis mass anxiety. They were not trying to incite every single minute of the day. And Donald Trump does do that. And I think that is incredibly dangerous. And it does set him apart. And the problem is that a next president, whoever it is, that is not something that is easily able to be just repealed, right? You can repeal a law, you can repeal a rule, you can repeal, you know, whatever kind of regulation you want, but it's very hard to quickly repeal the psychological trauma that Donald Trump has, assaulted America with. I mean, yeah. It is not easy to, it's going to take a long time to heal from that. I mean, it's sort of the genie out of the bottle metaphor that once what he's unleashed is unleashed, it's very hard to put it all back together. It's going to take a lot of work. And so I think that as we think about this election, you know, I do think that Joe Biden has not run a very inspiring campaign. Joe Biden has a pretty uninspiring public record. I stipulate all of that. Joe Biden has been too close to the financial industry, too close to his big donors. All of that is stipulated. But I do not think Joe Biden has been a politician who has woken up every day, or would be a president who would wake up every day trying to incite and inflame and psychologically destabilize the country. And so if you think about the election in terms of harm reduction, you know, these are not moral choices. It's an immoral system presenting choices that are so far from perfect. But if you think of the election purely as a harm reduction exercise, then I think the choice of who we should want to win this election should be pretty clear.
Let me shift back in time. I do not view Donald Trump as a Martian who descended from outer space. I view him as the byproduct of a despair that was engendered by the neglect of many things that matter from both parties over the 40 years that preceded Donald Trump's nomination. He ran around places like Detroit, where I grew up, and let out, "The system is rigged, and all of the top executives at the auto companies have let down America. They let the jobs go elsewhere while they made more money, and they put money offshore, etc." So at some level, you're right, he's inciting that anxiety, that despair. But at some level, he was triggering something that was latently already embedded because of what you might call a broken system of governance. I'm not saying he's made it better. What I'm saying is the preconditions where people would listen to it. And now, like you've said, he's cultivated, he's brought it out to the surface, and it's hard to put that genie back in the bottle. But there was something trapped in that bottle that was really desperate to get out. And that's why I think he won the nomination and beat 15 Republicans before beating Hillary Clinton.
I completely agree. And look, I wrote a book, my second book that I wrote was called The Uprising. And it was, the thesis of the book was that the economic system had created such despair in the country, such inequality in the country, that politics would end up becoming a competition between who could most successfully channel that despair into their political program, progressives or right-wing nationalists and white supremacists. That was the thesis of the book back in 2007, 2008. And what we have learned is that the right has been far more successful in channeling that anger and outrage, and that Donald Trump is the culmination of their success in doing that. But their success in doing that is also a failure of the Democratic Party, the left in America. I don't love using that term because I think the so-called left in America is extremely small in terms of as an organized political movement. But essentially the left side of American politics has failed to channel that righteous and understandable anger at an unfair economic system, that failed to channel that into their political program. And one of the big reasons is that the Democratic Party, the vehicle for channeling that, is caught in a zero-sum competition between serving the people on one side and serving its big donors on the other side. And that is a zero-sum competition. Barack Obama tried. His thesis was that he could make those two things work together. You can serve the billionaires and you can serve the people. You can serve the health insurance companies and you can serve sick people, the patients. And you can't. You cannot put those two things together. It sounds like a nice story that you can put them together and everyone can be happy, but that is not how power works. There is force and there is countervailing force. And if you try to pretend that there's some middle ground on these binary issues, what you're really doing is you're trying to deceive the voting population into thinking there's a way to make billionaires happy and also serve the public interest. And there, we have learned now over and over again that that is impossible. And so if the Trump era ends, if Donald Trump is voted out of office, we once again have a chance with a likely weak Democratic president in office to make a different choice, that the new administration would have a chance to make a different choice away from this so-called sort of third way politics that posits that there is a way to appease corporations and billionaires and serve the people. We can make a change away from that to a politics that views for force and countervailing force in an honest way, and then side with countervailing force against corporate power. That is what happened under Franklin Roosevelt. And I think the thing that people don't fully understand about the New Deal, which, you know, was obviously a political program that served the working class in a very direct and serious way. I mean, you can critique certain parts of it. Maybe this wasn't perfect, maybe that wasn't perfect. But in general, it was an agenda designed to serve the working class, spearheaded by a president who, under pressure from a set of mass movements, went out and said that he welcomed the hatred of plutocrats, that agenda served the working class. And the thing that I think people don't fully understand about the New Deal is that it was not only moral, it was not only macroeconomically necessary to deal with the Great Depression, but it also was incredibly important in helping prevent the rise of fascism in America. That's the part of the New Deal that I think people don't fully appreciate. That it wasn't just a set of policies that were necessary. It wasn't just that we needed a Keynesian infusion of government spending to help the macro economy. It's that in having a presidency that championed an agenda that was all about delivering for the working class, it made it harder for the Donald Trumps of that era to cite the failures or corruptions of a corporatist centrist Democratic administration. It made it harder for those Donald Trumps of that era to say, look at that party that's in power, they're not serving you. I, a right-wing fascist nationalist, I will serve you. That FDR's agenda made it harder for the fascists to win. And here's the thing, the fascists wanted to win back then. There was a real fascist movement in the United States back then, just like there is now. And so when we think about the New Deal in that frame, and we think about it in a potential Biden administration, that it's not just that a populist progressive agenda is necessary morally for a country where millions of people are losing healthcare and people are being thrown out of their homes and people are jobless in a pandemic. It's not just necessary macroeconomically in terms of getting the whole economy, prompting demand to get the whole economy back on its feet. A presidency that actually takes seriously the fight to deliver for the working class is also necessary to prevent the rise of the next Donald Trump, who, if that new Democratic administration fails and repeats, for instance, the Obama administration's surrenders and capitulations, a right wing will say, look at that new, you just elected another Democratic president. They sided with their donors. They're failing again. Vote for this new fascist we're putting up there in 2024.
I think you're right. And, in those days, they also advertised in the days after Woodrow Wilson that on the other side was communism. So they were, how would I say, with the New Deal, they were softening things vis-a-vis the risk of fascism or vis-a-vis the attraction to a communist vision and form of government like the Soviet Union as well. But I think as I look at this, let me describe something. A few months ago, someone shared with me a podcast that was made in, I believe it was 2011, and an artist and thinker named Stuart Zechman was on a podcast and talking about how an unnamed official from the Obama administration appearing on Politico could say definitively that we can't go back to be like the No Deal. And the reason we can't go back to be like the New Deal is because when you look at the Gallup polls, people don't believe in governments anymore. And what Zechman did that was, I thought, just brilliant, is as he came on this podcast, he dug deeply into the Gallup polls, and what did he uncover? I'll use shorthand language. That the distrust among progressives of government is they thought it was all captured by plutocrats and corporations. In other words, it was a money-dominated system during the Obama administration that wasn't representing people. And as you know, as well as anybody, the House turned Republican, the Senate turned Republican, and Trump was elected. And many of people, like our mutual friend, Celinda Lake, the pollster, when Martha Coakley lost after Teddy Kennedy passed away in a by-election, she said the biggest issue they talked about was the bonuses at J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. And that, as Joe Stiglitz said, the polluters got paid. So I guess what I'm asking you is, in a system which is prone to capture of both sides, despair was emerging, whether what I'll call neoliberal Clintonista or the Bush-Cheney years or Obama, who's architecture of the financial bailout didn't seem to penalize the perpetrators. Finance got off pretty easily. So when you look at all of these things, I guess what I'm asking you is, if Biden is elected, yes, that sigh of relief about the person who's inciting our anxiety would be diminished. But do the Democrats want to go back to inside the Beltway, hostile takeover, working with the capture and anesthetize all of us because we're supposed to thank them for getting rid of this demonic spirit and now they're free to do what they want? And
I think that's the calculation. I mean, there was Hillary Rosen is a Democratic consultant, a corporate consultant as well, who's close to the Biden campaign. And I'm not picking on her, but she said it explicitly in the Washington Post over the weekend before the election. She said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but she said, Joe Biden will not be there to disrupt Washington. He will be there to heal Washington.
Mm-hmm. But
there is going to be an effort to portray the election as a popular desire to restore the old establishment, the old swamp, to power. And I think that's a misreading of the election. And by the way, I think it's a deliberate misreading of the election. That's a deliberately false narrative to justify a certain set of policies and marginalize another set.
Right. In other words, we got to pay off all the rent-seeking interests because they did us a favor of getting rid of Donald Trump. And so we should leave them alone and let them do a victory lap and fill their own pockets and salt their own beaks.
Yeah, or the other way to look at it is like, oh, you know, people might have hated the Washington swamp, the Washington establishment, but then we got Donald Trump. And now, you know what? Maybe people learned to love the Washington. Maybe the swamp and the establishment wasn't so bad. I don't think that's actually how it works. I don't think that's actually what's going on in voters' minds. I think that you can dislike two things at once. You can dislike the old swamp, the old Washington establishment, and you can dislike Donald Trump. And voting to get rid of Donald Trump is not a vote of validation to a return to a pre-Trump status quo that ended up creating Donald Trump. There's a whole different alternative outside of the binary choice between Trump and the Democratic establishment. There's a desire for something beyond those two choices.
I guess where I think this all circles back, David, is that if you would agree with me that Donald Trump was the byproduct of an insensitive, unrepresentative system, going back to business as usual sows the seeds of a next Trump-like character when despondency and dissatisfaction and despair are the byproduct of all these elected officials. And I'm not talking about their morality here as people, other than when, like you described, that they're deceptive. They are constrained. If you want to survive, you got to pay attention to money, lobbyists, PR, power, etc. You got to appoint people who will not enforce the rules on your big donors. Many people think that Trump's pandemic COVID-19 bailout was basically a payoff to the people he hoped would be his donors. The question becomes, if the Democrats are in power and they want to attenuate, diminish, extinguish this propensity towards fascism, this despair, this polarity, this genie that's now out of the bottle, what change in the system do we need to create, regain trust and faith in broad-based prosperity and opportunity?
Well, it's a huge question. I think that we need a culture that says that the elected officials work for us. We do not work for them. That our job is not to be loyal to a party a party's job is to be loyal to what we, the people, actually want and need. It is an entire attitudinal shift that is very, very difficult in a politics in which the threat of an extremist opposition ends up pressuring everybody to fall in line and keep quiet in the name of preventing the boogeyman from returning to power. I mean, it is, we have lived through the last few months an extremely stifling environment in which you can't ask the Democrats to do much of anything for fear of being accused of helping Donald Trump. That is a really, really horrible dynamic when the thing that's being asked of the Democrats and the Republicans is their life and death kinds of things. You know, please help us stop a wildfire that's destroying the West Coast. Please help people get access to medical care during a lethal pandemic. Please prevent landlords from evicting thousands of people during an economic crisis and the coronavirus outbreak. These are life and death demands, and it's very hard to make them in a political system in which you will be accused of helping the other side by even making those demands and those requests. So I think part of what needs to happen is a psychological reframing where we understand that actually it's our job as citizens to make demands of a government that's supposed to be working for us, and that this is a Jedi mind trick to try to keep us quiet. That in local, state, federal races, if my representative or senator from the party that I affiliate with is not delivering for me, it is my job as a citizen to support a primary challenge to that lawmaker when they are up for re-election. It is not my job to just fall in line and be loyal. If my representative is not delivering, or at least trying to deliver, the basic necessities of life to my community. That is a radical concept now. We live in a society in which media propaganda, cable TV news, newspapers, punditry, is all, much of it is designed to make us think that our job as citizens is to be loyal to our party rather than the job of the party being loyal to a people-first agenda. That is a huge attitude.
I'll take a hypothetical that's on the horizon. A number of people thought, with her supervision of the TARP process, the Congressional Oversight Committee, and then the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that Elizabeth Warren, being a Treasury Secretary and governing finance, would be a breath of fresh air for the people at large. And when I was in and around affluent Democratic Party donors, what they said is we couldn't possibly do that with the Biden administration because it would chase Wall Street's donations over to Trump. Or even beyond that, it would chase Wall Street's donations for the midterm election in 2022. And there may be a logic to that, but what it's saying is that that broad-based representation of the people isn't as important to electoral success as pandering to money. And I think that we've got to get to the root of what stops these systems from being what I'll call organically representative. What kind of things with regard to voter suppression, gerrymandering, money in politics, different types of appointments, etc. What kind of a menu would you envision for what pressure activist groups and citizens should put on their local and their state and their federal representatives to repair the system?
Well, I think that, one, on your point about money and is Wall Street money going to go help the Republicans? And, you know, obviously at the root of much of this is a political system that is reliant on private money. So a political system that is reliant on private money is going to be much more responsive to private money when it comes to policy. So anything that can make it easier for people to run decently funded campaigns in America is a way to potentially get a better political system. So, I mean, on an agenda item, a public policy item, you know, public financing of elections at the state, local, and federal level. I mean, that's a huge thing. But I also think that the good news is, even in lieu of public financing of elections, we have seen small dollar donations be able to raise just an enormous amount of money. And I think that's a welcome development in absence of public financing of elections, that at least there are ways for more candidates to run for office in campaigns in which it is not just the proverbial smoke-filled room with industrial moguls and suitcases of cash. So I think the whole idea that, oh, we can't be, you know, be for a good policy, a good economic policy, because it might make Wall Street billionaires mad. I mean, that's certainly still going to be a factor, but it's less of a factor in a politics where at least some candidates can have a legitimate hope to raise grassroots money. It's not a cure-all, but it's something. I think that, you know, pushing. I would put it also this way, that I do think there are certain issues in which there is more agreement across economic classes in this way. That if we understand that it's really not a 99% versus 1% split on many issues, it's really a 99.8% versus 0.2%. That is to say that the 1% really is almost a too crude a conception to understand what's going on in our economy, that the difference between somebody at the bottom of the 1% versus somebody in the top 0.5% is unbelievably huge. And what that says is that there are certain issues in which that are a crisis for somebody in the 1% and in folks who are in the 99%. Now, certainly it's not as much of a crisis for somebody. You know, I think the bottom end of the top 1% is something like $300,000, $350,000, something like that per year of income. The healthcare premiums are less of a problem for somebody in that income sphere. Absolutely. Less of a problem than for somebody in the 50th percentile, obviously. But it is still potentially a problem that private insurance rips people off, even for somebody in the 1%. Not as much of a problem, but still a problem. Climate change, probably an even better example, climate change is a problem for everybody. Now, it's certainly a worse problem for low-income communities living near fossil fuel development or living on a floodplain or living near an ocean than it is for rich people who can buy a bunker or at least fortify their homes and their businesses. But it is still a problem there's no way to completely hide from that problem. And so the only reason I bring this up is that I do think on some of these issues, there is a way to build coalitions that can change policy, because the power coalitions can be split apart. Climate change is a good example. I would argue that the primary beneficiary of a status quo in energy policy are oil and gas companies and their owners and their shareholders. That is a relatively tiny number of people versus, let's say, the entire planet. And so there is, I think, a chance in the next few years for real pressure to be brought to bear on legislators to actually deliver transformational change, because those legislators are also hearing, not just from, you know, progressives, not just from Democrats, they're hearing from small business owners, they're hearing from all sorts of people, and this has become a threat to the larger economy. Now, of course, the problem with the politics that I'm outlining here is that there are other problems that are particular, arguably singular crises for groups outside of the top 1%. And so how do you get the government and policymakers to focus on those crises? Example, the eviction crisis. The eviction crisis almost specifically affects people lower down on the income scale, because it is ultimately a matter of whether you can pay your rent or pay your mortgage. And so that is a major crisis. That is a major crisis. I don't know if it's for 60% of the people, 70% of the people, whatever percentage it is, it's a huge crisis for a large number of people. How do you make a government owned by the 1% take seriously a problem that is a problem primarily, if not exclusively, for, let's say, the bottom 50% or 60%? That is the fundamental question of our time. And I wish I had a good answer to it, but I don't have a great answer to it.
I guess in a dual currency system where one currency is called dollars and the other is called votes, you might want to upweight the importance of votes relative to dollars. Public funding of elections.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's a good point. Yes. Yes, that, and I should add that you know, it's easier to organize money than it is to organize people, because money, mm-hmm. lots of money is in the hands of a few people. So you only have to organize, when you're organizing money, you only have to organize a few people in order to organize lots of money.
Yes. But what we have, organize things not with but for small amounts of people with money, social unrest and social unsustainability is the inevitable byproduct.
100%. And so I think the other solution to this is, and it's, you know, I guess the point I should have said before is that it's not a silver bullet solution, it's not an easy solution, but it is the only solution, which is that if a problem affects the bottom 70% of people and doesn't really affect the top 30 or 20 or 10% of the population, the only way to get the government to actually take it seriously is for the bottom 70%, and by bottom I mean lowest earning 70%, is to have that population as politically organized as possible, to make sure that if and when a politician chooses their donors over that 70%, that there are political consequences for that. And the thing is that I think we've seen evidence that that is possible at the local and state level in recent years, which is something that we should, that is extremely encouraging. I mean, you've seen establishment Democrats thrown out of office in places like Pennsylvania and the legislative races there, and Rhode Island and the legislative races there. I mean, I am the spouse of a state legislator who ran and won an underdog primary here in the swing state of Colorado. So you've seen that, more and more of those successes. Then obviously you go up to the congressional level. You've seen AOC, you've seen Cori Bush, you've seen Jamal Bowman win these primaries. People-powered primaries against entrenched establishment, corporate-aligned incumbents. And that is really, really encouraging. That is what we're talking about here. But I do think that is a long slog, and it's a worthwhile slog. And we've seen, at least for now, I think there's been somewhat of a cap on it in this sense, that there's been a ceiling. To my mind, the farthest we've seen that movement get in the political sphere, in the electoral sphere, is the U.S. House. If you look across the Senate races in this election, the Democratic Senate candidates are, I would, having not done all the research, but I would probably argue is the most conservative corporate aligned set of Democratic Senate nominees that we have seen in a very, very long time. I can barely point to one Senate candidate who is not at best a middle of the road corporate friendly Democrat. Maybe the one candidate, Reverend Warnock, running in Georgia is more progressive than most of the other Democratic nominees. And so if there's a Democratic Senate, it could end up being the most conservative Democratic Senate in a very, very long time. And so my point is only that there's been sort of a ceiling there where the establishment, whether it's, and I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, but the establishment has been able to make sure that no real motivated movement, progressive populist, has been able to, in recent years, crack into the Senate or crack into a major state's governor's office. I mean, you had Bernie Sanders got elected a long time ago, so that's sort of a special case. Elizabeth Warren, she was able to do it, and that was, again another somewhat special case. And again, it was also a relatively long time ago. But what we've seen is a kind of consolidation, especially in this election year, where the Democratic Party's bosses still had the power to prevent progressive populist candidates from becoming Democratic nominees and getting into the Senate. And we need to recognize that for what it is, which is they see this movement happening at the state house level, the U.S. House level, and the foot has been put down.
Yeah, and I see, how would I say, a whole lot of things where the foot needs to be put down. I just finished making a video with the famous whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg about his new book called The Doomsday Machine, which describes, and he's trained like a game theorist, PhD economist, how the whole logic of mutual assured destruction is very flawed when, if somebody makes some mistakes and these missiles are fired, it will destroy the upper atmosphere, create a nuclear winter, and exterminate more than 95% of humanity. And yet we can't get experts to come out and talk about that. And people in the military-industrial complex continue to lobby for modernization and adding to the scale of the missile systems. And so I think we've got some very deep, some of the things like you and I've been talking about a little bit at my suggestion was changing the incentive system to make people more responsive. But we also have lots of people who would like to go to school where the schools are totally inadequate and we're spending over $1 trillion on weapon systems. There's just a great deal of what I'll call habit about honoring money and honoring military power that appears to have, in some ways, gone off the rails in a way that engendered a despair that produced a Donald Trump, except now Donald Trump appears to be the person who's exacerbating those tendencies. And that, it's very hard to imagine without consistent uprising, to quote your title of your second book, how we're going to push this system to a place where the risk of degeneration doesn't reemerge and reemerge and reemerge. And if I were a brilliant young entrepreneur right now who knew I had good ideas and I could make hundreds of millions of dollars, I would be afraid that the stability of the structure of the system will never, how would I say, be long-lasting enough to allow me to deploy my brilliance. I don't know how we're going to get through this, which you might call reorientation, this re-envisioning of what a good life is. But I am very grateful for people like yourself and activists and protesters who are standing up in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, seeing the weaponized law enforcement and prison systems that don't teach people. And even, you know, even the Koch brothers have made noise about how when the prisons have all these people incarcerated and they don't educate them so they can come back out, it costs society money. Now, their concern is wealth, maybe more than humanity, but how do you say we got to use the forces of pressure? But it's going to take, as Neil Young and Nicolette Larson say, it's going to take a lot of love to sustain and change the way things are. And
I totally agree, and I think that you know, two things basically have to happen, which is that, and I think in one respect we're there, in another respect we may not be. I think the first thing that needs to happen is that more people need to understand the stakes of what's going on and understand that a failure to act will mean more and more pain. And I think we're there, right? I mean, there's this whole idea that things have to get worse before they get better. I don't think they have to get worse before they get better, because I think lots and lots of people understand and are experiencing things that are pretty terrible right now. And I think when people say things have to get worse before they get better, in some respects, it kind of downplays the pain that people are going through right now. I don't think we have a problem where people don't understand how bad things are. I don't think that. But I also think that the people who rule in our name and who rule the economy, the ruling class itself, also has to understand that things for the ruling class will get worse unless there are improvements. I mean, this is the story of every terrible descent into mayhem that has befallen civilizations of the past. You know, you tell people, let them eat cake. You tell the serfs, let them eat cake. And guess what? Then you've got the guillotines on your hands. The feudal lords tell the serfs to go starve, and sooner or later the serfs are doing all sorts of things that's in the name of revolution that are terrible for society, although the motivation itself, the desperation, is obviously understandable. I mean, it's the JFK quote, and I'm going to butcher it here, but it's, you know, what is it? It's that those who make peaceful progress impossible make violent revolution inevitable. I've just butchered the quote, but you get the point. That's the basic JFK quote. And I think that the ruling class of this country has not fully appreciated that. And that some folks who, you know, who are actual billionaires maybe don't even care, because they think they're so isolated from it that they don't have to care. But ultimately, when we talk about something like climate change, no one is isolated from that. Some people might have it better than others, but nobody is ultimately isolated from that. And what's amazing to me at this moment in history is that more people in the ruling class don't seem to realize this, even as the fabric of society seems to be tearing apart. That more people, you know, we talked about the 1%, the top, one half of 1%, the top 0.1 tenth of 1%. What's amazing to me is that more folks in, let's say, the 1% to the 0.5%, people with a lot of relatively large amount of political and economic power, still don't seem to fully understand in a lot of ways, at least through their political behavior and their political donations, et cetera, still don't seem to fully understand even their own self-interest in a system that would be more equitable. maybe they don't understand, maybe they don't want to understand, maybe they don't think there is any self-interest. Maybe they just, you know, they're just so used to the greed is good idea, they don't care. But my point is that there's only so far you can stretch a system into a feudal kind of inequality before there really is a backlash even worse than Donald Trump, one that I guarantee you the ruling class will not really like. Even the people who are rich will not really like. And that's what's amazing to me is that ruling class hasn't seemed to really appreciate that. And the other thing that's amazing to me, although I think we've seen more of it lately, is that it's kind of amazing that it's taken this long. There's been so much pain for so many years. It's kind of amazing it's taken this long for the American population to become finally as engaged as it appears to have become. I mean, I know that there are people I know who don't live in this country who have wondered to me some version of, you know, I can't believe how much pain and suffering the working class in this country has accepted without getting really radical and revolutionary. Like if this was happening in my country, you'd have people in the streets all the time. And it sort of speaks to, and it's a subject for a whole other conversation, but not exactly how docile our population is, but maybe how beaten down and burnt down and burned out the large swaths of the country have become after decades and decades and decades of economic and political dislocation. But ultimately, if things keep getting worse, as I put it this way, if, as Joe Biden has one time promised his donors, if things will not fundamentally change under a Biden administration, then everything is going to change for the worse. In other words, if the attitude is that I can create a status quo that is causing so much pain and suffering, and my job is to not change the system that creates that pain and suffering, then everything is going to change, and everything is going to change for the worse. And it would be better to try to prevent that from happening, a devolution into a totally nihilistic sort of radicalized situation. It would be better to try to prevent that up front than having to go through it, because going through it is no pleasant road.
That's right. I'm reminded of two song lyrics that you inspired. One is, Bob Dylan talks about a hard rain's gonna fall, but he has a song called Masters of War. And he says, let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. But as that daunting prospect, that sense of insecurity amongst the wealthy and the powerful surrounds us, we have an inspiration here in the pandemic, in the aftermath of George Floyd, that comes from Teddy Pendergrass when he was with Harold Melvin of the Blue Notes. And he says, wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war, and poverty. Then he goes on, wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say, because they're the ones who are coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The chorus, the world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We got to change it, yeah. Just you and me. I think the pressure from below and the awakening in the context of the pandemic and climate change and the difficulties associated with law enforcement, race relations, and prisons, the threat of nuclear war, I think the wake-up call is plenty strong. And I encourage you to keep the pressure on. Keep the pressure on all of us, because it is a time for action. And having said that, I also, again, want to wish you a happy birthday and take in for some time out of this day when we all can celebrate you and your life and what you give to us.
Thank you, Rob. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate all the work that you do. And, you know, one thing I'll say is that it's been a long road. I've been lucky to have people like you in my life. And on a day like today, I feel genuinely grateful that I've been able to do this work, knowing that I have people like you in my life who have been so supportive and always there for me. So I do feel a great sense of gratitude today. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And as Teddy said, the world won't get no better. We got to change it. Yeah, just you and me. Well, there are more of you and me, but you're a tremendous catalyst and a tremendous visionary. Let's talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks again, man.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.